thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 19 for the 16th of January, 2008. Big things in small packages. I'm Dan Cohen. Well, welcome to our first podcast of 2008. We're looking forward to another year of podcasting at Digital Campus. And of course, as always, we are podcasting here live from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in scenic Fairfax, Virginia, right outside the nation's capital. And Tom Scheinfeld is here with me at the Center for History and New Media. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And we have an overseas visitor, but someone who's well-known to the Digital Campus groupies out there. Hi, Mills. Where are you calling from today?
I'm calling in from Vienna, Austria today.
Ah, and how are things in Vienna, Austria?
Cold and foggy today, but otherwise good.
Great. And what are you doing over there?
I'm leading a student study tour to Prague, Vienna, and Budapest, and so we're kind of at the halfway point.
Great. Terrific. Well, the Skype, again, sounds terrific. Probably should have been on our top 10 list from a couple of weeks ago, but I think Skype is still one of those big sort of silent stories. I mean, just the quality of this is terrific, and the ability to do it overseas like this is fantastic. Well, let's dig right into our news stories from the past couple of weeks and how we always begin the podcast. But first, a little note from the Center for History and New Media. I think there's a couple of initiatives that Tom wanted to mention that I think will be of interest to our audience. Tom, we have two new, we have a new podcast and a new a sort of summer camp, I guess you could call it. Do you want to talk about those briefly?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we're very pleased to announce another addition to the CHNM podcasting stable, CHNM Podcasting Network. We've got a new podcast coming online either the end of next week or the end of this week or early next, and it's called That Podcast, and that stands for the Humanities and Technology Podcast. So we've got That Podcast coming online. That's a production by CHNM's creative lead, Jeremy Boggs, and one of our crack web developers here, and actually a great student of digital humanities, Dave Lester. They're launching that podcast, really showing us up here at Digital Campus with an interview with Matt Mullenweg, the founder and head of WordPress, the popular blogging platform. So that's going to be a video podcast, actually, and the format's going to be a short interview with someone of interest to the digital humanities community, and then followed by a short sort of hands-on, very practical tutorial in how to do something. So how to build a WordPress theme or something like that. And so it's going to mix an interview with something, you know, very practical. And I think it's going to be a fantastic new podcast. And I encourage everybody to go to That Podcast, thatpodcast.org.
That should be great. And what else did you want to mention?
Right. And so then there's another initiative, kind of riffing on that theme. It's called That Camp, the Humanities and Technology Camp. And what we're going to do is, together with Dave and Jeremy, is we're going to have a brief weekend-long summer bar camp style unconference on digital humanities here at the Center for History and New Media. And that's going to happen on May 31st and June 1st. And the idea basically is just to bring together a bunch of people, Digital Campus listeners, hopefully among them, a bunch of people together here at the Center for History and New Media, and very informally present ideas we're working on, software demos, have informal training sessions, discussions of research findings, various other things in a very kind of informal way. If people are familiar with Barcamp, it's going to be that kind of thing where people kind of turn up. We're not presenting formal papers or anything. It's not a conference like that. It's more of a meetup where people can share ideas and form new collaborations. And instead of people just listening to papers, everyone who attends is expected to participate in some way make some tangible contribution to the conference. And so that's called that camp. And you can find the announcement for it and send us an application, which really is just an email letting us know that you're interested. You can find that information about that at thatcamp.org, thatcamp.org. So we're really excited about these two new initiatives, and hope people will take a look.
Sounds great. All right. Well, I will certainly be there. I'm looking forward to that. And for those who haven't been to an unconference, I mean, I think this is a new trend. I think it's a great trend, having just come from the AHA, where things tend to be very formal. There's a panel that's up on a stage and giving presentations, and everyone sort of listens dutifully. This is going to be something much more interactive, where I think communities of interest will sort of get together around a table with some laptops and hash out some things, learn some things. So looking forward to that for this summer. Thanks, Tom. Well, it's a new year, and I suppose we're always supposed to be optimistic at the beginning of the year, but we noticed a lot of pessimistic, melancholy stories full of sorrow and things going south. Three in particular that we wanted to mention in our news roundup. The first one, which I think probably didn't get as much coverage as it should have, considering how prominent this browser and company used to be, but Netscape is going away after all these years. I mean, I think it's been 13 or 14 years since Netscape, which those of us who remember the early rise of the web and the excitement around it. I mean, Netscape was really the Google of the mid-1990s. It was the first stock that really took off and made people millionaires and billionaires. And, it just sort of has this quiet death here. It had been acquired, the Netscape browser, by AOL. They actually acquired Netscape Communications Corporation in 1999. And, they converted it to open source software, and lots of things happened from there. Of course, Mozilla also came out of this rocky period for Netscape, and that, of course, led to Firefox. It seems like they're just sort of seeding the kind of alternative to Internet Explorer market to Firefox. Is that your read on this, Mills and Tom?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And when I saw the news story, I had this brief pang of sort of sadness about it, because I can still remember creating my first web page with Netscape Composer, which disappeared a long time ago.
Right.
But that was really the first easy tool for creating web pages for people who knew nothing about it.
Yeah, I think it is kind of the end of an era. I think Netscape, even though, really it was only a few years there where it was a major player in the browser space, it was fairly quickly with the launch of Windows 95, which bundled Internet Explorer with it, and the browser wars that ensued. It was really by 1999, when AOL acquired Netscape, the browser wars had kind of been decided. But the core of Netscape, which was released as Mozilla, kind of kept an alternative alive. And Netscape really does live on in Firefox. And in many ways, the browser wars are alive and well. And Firefox, the descendant of Netscape, is actually doing quite well. And I don't think anybody in 1999, when Netscape went to AOL, and then later when the Mozilla Corporation and Foundation were spun off from that, anybody would have predicted the success of this successor to Netscape. And so it's really a great story. And so while I mourn Netscape with some sadness, I think that we can all be hopeful that much of it lives on today, and in fact the code base really does live on very much so in Firefox, and all the products that have been built on Netscape technologies, on the Gecko rendering engine, on the Thunderbird email client, which was the email client that was built into Netscape, there's actually even Mills, the composer lives on. I guess the Mozilla has a product called NView. Is that? I think that's the name of it. So it does. It really lives on in the Mozilla Foundation. And so, you know, hopefully it will continue to do well.
Right. And I guess the important point here is that Netscape was, I think, very importantly, if you remember early on in 94, 95, they weren't talking about themselves as a browser company. The whole point was that they were trying to build a platform. I think that's what really excited people. And a platform that was network-based, that was web-based, that's why the early browsers had web composition built into them and not just browsing built in. They also had email and all these other things. You know, their whole point was, you know, Microsoft's there, they're a monopoly, but there's this new thing, the internet, that's taking off, and this new web technology that makes the internet very easy for people, for instance, in academia, non-technical users, to kind of participate in the internet, to post things on the internet, to read things off the internet in a rich environment. And they sort of saw that as, in a sense, a kind of new operating system or a new platform. And I think that's really their legacy, is that it was a sort of alternative to the desktop model. Now, you know, in some sense, it's ended up being more of a browser ultimately, and they never really got there. But I think the web in general has obviously taken off so much, and I think they were the first company to really have that vision of what the web could be.
Yeah, and I think they were just maybe a little too far ahead of their time. I mean, and in fact, now the remnants of the Netscape code base that live on in Mozilla are really being used as a platform. I mean, look at Zotero. Zotero is built directly on what the descendants of the Netscape platform. So
yeah, you know, if you're a programmer and you actually look under the hood at Firefox, as we do for the Zotero project, there are so many system calls and various pieces of code in Firefox that begin with NS, which was the Netscape insignia sort of in the code. So it'll be NS underline and then some other function. And those are all, you know, the original Netscape code is kind of there. It's really interesting sort of, you know, as a historian of science, to look under the hood and see those kind of legacies of the earlier iterations of the software. So it's there.
Maybe someday there'll be like software archaeologists who actually look through the code base of something like Zotero and find these legacies of older programs.
Yeah. Well, goodbye Netscape, and but of course Firefox still is coming on strong and building market share worldwide very quickly, actually. So you know, I think it does. It's a continuing story. Well, two other more minor stories, perhaps. I think that build on what we were talking about last week in our year-end wrap-up. I think the first one, Mills, you had speculated about the problems with adult-type material in educational environments. And I think you were talking about Second Life and the problems there, and I'll talk about Second Life in just a second. But we did notice that one of the big alternatives to Facebook, which is called Ning, N-I-N-G. A lot of people might not have heard of Ning, but interestingly, here there's a Netscape connection, because Ning was founded and funded by Mark Andreessen, who was the young programmer who started what became the Netscape Communications Corporation. So, and Mark's been doing a lot of things. He's done some cloud computing companies, but he started this social networking company called Ning, where you can kind of set up your own social networks for different places and corporations. And it's kind of like a, you know, they call it a white label service, where you can kind of, it's a blank slate that has all the networking components, and then you put on top of it what your community wants. Well, it turns out that what the Ning community wants is porn, because evidently quite a bit of what goes on in Ning is sort of porn-related social networking. And I think, I guess, Mills, this speaks to your the problems that you were saying about sort of bringing some of these new tools like social networking or virtual worlds into the educational space.
Yeah, I mean, it's the problem of the open environment in what for education is difficult to deal with because, you know, we, especially for K-12 education, it can't be an open environment like that because you do have users in this open environment who use it for the things that they happen to be interested in. And in their case, they happen to be interested in porn and lots of them. And so that really kind of means that school systems that have no time to sort of investigate the merits of the situation are just going to say, no, we're not going to allow that to be used. And, you know, I was talking really about Second Life when we discussed this earlier, but it's just really a problem of the kind of open community like that.
Right, right. Yeah, well, and speaking of Second Life, just to squeeze in another story on this sort of march south, the pessimistic news roundup that we've got here, is that Second Life, and perhaps for these very reasons, because of the creepiness of it, especially for new users, seems to be stalling out. We noted a very good sort of summation from Brian Alexander over at Liberal Education Today, who noted several sort of symptoms of, I think, what we speculated at. We've been Second Life pessimists for a year now on the podcast, but we did note that you know, Brian noted several things, that the active participants seems to have leveled off at about 500,000. You know, plateauing for any new web company is very unusual, just considering the way these things tend to grow exponentially. They've had a lot of service outages, he notes. They've lost their chief technology officer. The number of dollars spent in Second Life, remember, you can kind of create these virtual dollars, but you have to create them out of real dollars. And that's not only leveled off, but it's actually started to decline toward the end of the year. And, of course, they're losing sponsors like Pontiac, you know, and I think, you know, all that has to, you know, speaks to this question of, you know, these sort of amorphous open environments, you know, are they really going to work considering all the bad things that can happen there versus a structured environment?
Well, I think all of these bits of information from that article you cite, I think it's a pretty good indication that Second Life is pretty much done. And because, I mean, we all know these companies come and go so fast in the internet space that to be plateauing out this early and to have sponsors bailing out this early in their life means that people are just moving on to something else. And so it makes me really wonder about all the hype about you know, investing in Second Life as an educational platform. I think that that's probably money badly spent.
Yeah, I think it's truly amazing with all the amazing amount of publicity that Second Life has garnered, that they're actually starting to turn down. So I mean, you know, and I think it is one of these things where it's the technology's just not quite there yet. I think you go there and you kind of look around and you say, wow, this is cool. And then you go for your second time and you say, okay, well, wait, what else am I supposed to do here? And oh, by the way, this is a little creepy. And then you know, and it just and ultimately you kind of fall off. It doesn't surprise me really at all. But I do think it's – at the same time, I think it's important for people to be pushing these boundaries. I think even if Second Life only turns out to be an experiment and a failed experiment, I think we will have learned a lot of things from it about virtual worlds and you know, the potentials of them and also the problems with them. So I think we will see in 2008.
Well, Tom and Mills, I think one story we may have missed in our year-end wrap-up in Digital Campus number 18 was really just a big story on the micro-laptop front. And there's a lot of news on this over the last couple of weeks that we wanted to kind of bundle together and talk about maybe the role for these super small, super cheap laptops in academia, museums, and libraries. And, you know, that is, of course, the rise of the one laptop per child program in 2007. Obviously, this is directed at less at a college crowd than more at a perhaps elementary or middle school, and perhaps up to the high school level. And also, of course, it was intended to be for the international community, and particularly developing countries. Although in the last week, they've now said that they're going to try to push ahead and sell OLPCs, as they're known, or the XO, as the particular laptop that they're selling is called. The XO, which is a cheap $188 laptop, they're going to start selling it in the United States as well. And actually, you could buy it. They had a program in the Christmas season called, I think it was called Give One, Get One, where if you paid $400, you could give one of these $200 laptops to a kid in the developing world, and you got one for yourself. And actually, I saw one of these live from someone who did that in downtown Silver Spring, where I live. Right outside of Washington, there was a guy who had one of these XOs. And so I, of course, accosted him in a coffee shop and took a good look at it. And it's really an impressive piece of machinery for $188. I mean, the screen, as I think a lot of people have commented on, is pretty impressive. And it's got a really interesting new user interface, very, unlike the kind of standard laptop, Windows mouse environment that we're used to, big chunky icons. It has a kind of very Web 2.0 feel to it. And this guy was actually lamenting that there was no one else around with a OLPC, because he wanted to do one of these mesh networks that they're known for, where you can share an internet connection and they sort of automatically create these networks. And so we talked about that a little bit, but he did this, and I think they're still available under these buy one get one or give one get one programs. So it'd be nice to get one to play around with. And at the same time, there's been this rise. I mean, it's actually number two on Amazon.com. I just checked it out. Is this Asus EPC, which is a laptop that's selling for $399. It's very small, but it packs a lot in there, and it only has a 7-inch screen. I actually saw one of these also in a Panera. If you want to go to Panera, if you want to see new laptop technology, I guess is the takeaway point here. But
free Wi-Fi, yeah, every time.
Right. The screen's too small, but Tom, you had said that they're probably coming out with a larger screen on this, on the Asus.
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think one of the things, and I think this is one of the innovations that OLPC has really made, as you said, it's the screen is really one of the things that I think has kept laptop prices high. And I think OLPC has really innovated in building a screen that not only does more things than your normal screen, but also is quite a bit cheaper to produce than other screens. I think Asus, again, limited, they wanted to keep it under $400, and so they, with screen costs being what they were, they had to keep it at kind of a 7-inch screen. I think now they've found a way to reduce costs again, and they're releasing a new model that is, I think, has the same physical dimensions, case dimensions, as the old one, but it actually is going to just extend the screen further out towards the edges of the box, and I think it's going to be an 8-inch screen.
Yeah, so they'll really need to do that. I mean, there's this giant black border, about a 2-inch wide black border around the screen, and that's the only drawback to it. Just to pause for a second and just flesh this out a little bit more. I mean, these are both laptops, the OLPC's XO and the Asus. And indeed, Tom, you noted before we got on the podcast that there's a third $399 PC coming out, or a third cheap ultra mobile from EverX called the Cloudbook, that's going to be sold at Walmart, of all places, for $399. Similar kind of dimensions, also 7-inch screen. To the Asus, it seems like there's a kind of budding market here. At the same time, we should note that a couple of the other stories in the past couple of weeks from OLPC is that Intel, one of the major corporate sponsors of the program, backed out, and that's of course because again, this is an open source project, and Intel's also in the business of selling their own cheap PCs, and I think that got in the way. They're trying to sell some cheap PCs that run Windows to governments. These are often government sales that drive the market. And also at the same time, I think as sort of matching this, Intel leaving the project, is that OLPC, I think in part because they need a bigger market for things like their screen, which are, the screen really is remarkable and I think a breakthrough. But since they've only sold, I think, about 150 or 200,000 of these OLPCs, they're trying to commercialize some of the technologies that make up the XO for other markets so that they bring the cost down through economies of scale. So the chief financial officer of OLPC left to actually create a new company, Mary Lou Jepson. I'm sorry, she was the chief technology officer. And interestingly enough, in this sort of Wagnerian opera between OLPC and Intel, she was actually a manager at Intel before she came to OLPC. But anyway, but she left to start a company called Pixel Qi. The Qi is actually the Chinese character QI is often how it's transliterated. And Qi, of course, being life energy, very much part of the Kumbaya, part of this OLPC project. But this is a for-profit company that's trying to, you know, get, for instance, the screen in other laptops or other cell phone-based platforms so that, you know, the manufacturers can produce enough of them. I mean, if they're producing them 100,000 at a time, the cost for the XO is going to stay at $200. And they had always wanted it to cost $100 or less. And the goal of Pixel Qi is to get the cost down even to maybe $75. And there, I think things get really interesting, as they're already getting interesting with these laptops, right? I mean, Mills, what are your thoughts about, you know, a laptop that goes down towards a kind of zero cost for, let's say, the K-12, but also the college market? I mean, are there new applications that happen there? Is it just that more and more people will be carrying around the laptop?
Well, I think one of the things in the college market that we'll see is that, I mean, if this really happens, then instead of four or five students in a class of 50 having laptops, more like 47 or 48 of the students will be carrying laptops. And then it's also possible to require it so that you're requiring students to be able to do things in class with the laptops. And so I think that opens up the possibility of all sorts of different teaching methods. And that's, I think, pretty exciting. I'm less sanguine about how it's going to go in the developing world, having spent time there. I don't think these machines are rugged enough for the environment that they're designing them for. I mean, I spent time in rural Cambodia this past spring, and these machines aren't going to survive physically in that kind of an environment.
Yeah, I mean, it looks rugged when you look at it, or at least, let's say, more rugged than a Mac laptop or most PC laptops. The keyboard is sealed off. The screen looks a little bit less finicky. But there are things like, for instance, the networking antenna. There are two of them that are, you know, sort of plastic, and they kind of stick up, or you should stick them up to get the maximum reception. You could see those kind of breaking off. I know that Negroponte, the head of the OLPC project, has talked about, well, these are going to be able to be repaired by the kids themselves. But it is, it's a tough thing to do, to try to do at this cost level.
But I got to say, I mean, I visited an elementary school in Cambodia. I think this is a wonderful project. I'm not slamming OLPC. I think it's a great thing, but I'm just not as enthusiastic. I'm enthusiastic in the long term, but this elementary school I visited had 4,000 students. It was the best school in its city. It was 4,000 students in a facility that holds 1,800. And so the kids can only go half a day. So that takes it down to 2,000 in a facility that holds 1,800, which meant that 200 of the kids had to be at recess at all times. And so with those kinds of problems, just the idea that you could then introduce a technology into that sort of environment, I think it's a little far-fetched at this particular moment.
Yeah.
I think actually OLPC's announcement just this weekend that they're moving into the American and especially urban inner city market is maybe a recognition of that. I think it's also a recognition of the fact that they've had a very hard time working and cutting the deals with foreign governments. I think their marketing strategy for the OLPC was always to cut deals, large deals, like to sell a million units to the government, to the education department and the government of Nigeria, for instance. And I think they've had a hard time cutting those deals, in part because of competition from Intel and other makers of low cost laptops and computers. But I think it is, there is some recognition that maybe they were maybe a little ahead of their time. Maybe it's a little too early to go after the developing world. Maybe the technology has to be refined, but that it's not too early to go after the developed world. And I think there's actually another kind of middle tier of countries which maybe aren't as the needs and the challenges aren't as hard as somewhere like Cambodia, but that that OLPC could target, let's say a place like Iran, where you know there's high level of literacy, there's relative stability in the politically, not problems like hunger and those kinds of problems aren't as severe, but maybe they haven't quite had a chance to develop technologically as much as they could. So I think there are some opportunities here. I think there's also an opportunity in terms of administration on college campuses and libraries and museums in the U.S. and in developed countries. I think one of the big things about this story is kind of the rise of Linux. All of these machines are running on Linux, and if they become popular, we could be seeing a real open source challenge finally, after years of it being predicted, to the commercial operating system.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. I mean, this really could be a beachhead for Linux in the environments that we circulate in higher ed and libraries and museums. Simply because when you get down to this cost level, at $400, or really when you get down even lower at $100 or $75 for a laptop, Microsoft charges anywhere between $50 and $100 per Windows installation to OEMs, to the manufacturers that they pass along. And so it becomes a huge chunk of the cost of a laptop. And so all these cheap laptops are going with Linux. The OLPC uses Linux that was created by Red Hat, which is one of the big Linux companies, a version of Linux that they created specifically for the OLPC. And EverX?
EverX Cloudbook.
Cloudbook, yes. And then the Asus, which is this hot seller on Amazon. They've sold over 300,000 of these on Amazon in the last few months. They're using, one is GOS, which sounds like it's Google's operating system, and I think that's probably an intentional misdirection by the company. But it's actually just a version of Ubuntu, which is already gaining popularity as a kind of very approachable, non-techie interface. It has a nice, pretty user interface that's put on top of Linux. And I think also this EverX machine, so that's the GOS, and the Asus is just a straight Ubuntu, right?
Asus, I don't know. Yeah,
okay, I can't remember.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. But
so you could see if a lot of students, and particularly Mills, as you said, it's like that sort of final third that aren't bringing their laptops to class. If they can get a laptop for $199, at the sort of iPod level of purchase, and they're going to all be using Linux. They might not even know it, but that right. sort of represents a beachhead there.
Right. That's the thing. I think it's like Linux is – it has almost been – I think one of the big problems Linux has always had was that it was so geeky. And and I think it just had this reputation, and as like the geek's operating system, and something I can't touch Linux. Linux is something that only those people can use. I need something more user friendly like Windows. I think they almost don't even know it. And the popularity of the Asus of the EPC shows that. I mean, this actually I think is the first time that Linux is really getting into ordinary consumers' hands on a large scale. And I know it's interesting, and that this EverX Cloudbook is going to be sold at Walmart. I know Walmart tried to do this a few years ago to sell very cheap, I think they were desktops, but very cheap desktops running a flavor of Linux.
Right.
And it just didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here for the first time, it seems to be really taking off among ordinary consumers, and that's, I think, the moment when it really stands a chance. It's been a good operating system for a long time, but it just wasn't in the hands of ordinary people. And I think that's just so necessary for it to actually take hold. If it does take hold, there are huge implications for institutional users. I mean, the licensing being the biggest one, the licensing costs of operating systems being the biggest one. So that could be a huge story in the coming year or two.
Right. I mean, a lot of this is predicated on a story that did make our top 10 for 2007, and that is so many of the applications moving onto the web. I mean, people using Gmail and using Google Docs and Zoho and Yahoo applications and all this stuff happening online rather than on your desktop. And indeed, actually, this is more echoes of Netscape. I mean, isn't it? Haven't we reached the point that Netscape thought we were going to be at in 1995, which is that so much is going out there on the web, on the network, and really, you know, Ubuntu is fine. You got Firefox with it. You open up Firefox. You look at your Gmail on it. You browse the web on it. You don't need those applications anymore. I would think that this is an interesting development in terms of, as you said, licensing, let's say, Microsoft, site licenses for Office, Microsoft Office, and the Microsoft operating system.
And I think if you look at the interface of this EverX Cloudbook with this GOS, this flavor of Ubuntu, it actually has a little dock at the bottom like you have on the Mac OS, OS X.
Right,
and
I see that.
It has links to Firefox and Gmail and Skype and Google Docs and Google Calendar and Wikipedia. But they don't look like internet links. They look like programs.
Application links, yeah.
They look like application links. Yeah. And I think most people are going to, you know, I think at this point, and especially younger users, they're going to go to this and they're going to say, oh, these are, you know, they're not discriminating between, you know, installed software applications, you know, sort of executables and web services. And
yeah, because they don't care. They just don't care.
They just wanted to do with what they needed to do. And I think this that there's kind of a little conceit in this interface, but I think it really works, and I think that could mean something very important for these web services as well.
Yeah, Mills, do you think that this also plays into what you've been pushing, which is, you know, on the cell phone front, it's the ubiquity of some kind of digital device that people are carrying with them, and the impact that has on the educational environment. You know, maybe it's everyone will have a cell phone interface and a super cheap £1, you know, or £2 laptop with a small screen, but it's good enough to, you know, carry out to, you know, the battlefields that we have near campus, the Civil War battlefields for a history project, or it's a more portable format than, you know, the 15-inch laptop.
Let me tell you, I wish I had one right now instead of lugging through Central Europe, the one that I'm lugging around that I'm calling on today. You know, I spent a lot of time on this trip out at various historic sites, and to be able to have some sort of ubiquitous device like that, boy, that would make this trip a lot easier for me. So I think that I think we're going to see a lot more of that, and I think from an educational standpoint, it makes it possible to demand that students do assignments, you know, out at the space, and so that'll help take them out of the classroom in ways that we haven't really been able to do yet.
Right, right. And you could see that, for instance, in a museum environment as well. Okay,
I was just going to say, I was at the Museum of Applied Arts here in Vienna yesterday, and they actually have little mini handheld computers now that you walk through the museum exhibits with. They're basically locked to the network within the building, but they're those little Dell handhelds. Mm. They look sort of like the old Palm Pilots, but and so you can, you know, get all sorts of information about whatever you're looking at.
Wow, it sounds like a great application. Let's begin our picks of the week with our caller from Vienna, Austria. Mills, what do you have for us from Europe?
Well, actually, it's a website from Sweden, from the Swedish National Library, and it's the reason I picked it is because it's the antithesis of what we were just talking about with the micro laptops, and it's a website on the world's largest book, the Codex Gigas, which I happened to see in Prague because it was in the Czech National Library this past week. It is a mammoth volume, and it is a Bible, not surprisingly. And it was produced in the 13th century in Bohemia, and it is. They had a whole display at the Czech National Library, and it was really fun to go through. But the website at the Swedish National Library has images of every single page, and what's remarkable about this book is it was produced over 30 years by one monk. And so it's his handwriting all the way through, which is just really incredible. But what's nice about the website is that you can zoom in on every single page. And he did all the illustrations and everything, and it's really an incredible thing. As a side note, it's in the Swedish National Library because when the Swedes invaded Bohemia in the 30 Years' War, they stole it. So, but it's really a fun. The Czechs are still sore about that, but it's a fun website to go through and look at the world's largest book.
Sounds great. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
I've actually got a piece of productivity software that I'd like to recommend. It's after talking about all these Linux laptops, it's kind of strange. I'm going to push a Mac-only product, but it's called Scrivener, and you can get it.
So
at, let's see, you can get it at literatureandlatte.com/scrivener.html. It's not the best URL in the world, but we'll put it in the show notes. And essentially, it is a tool for writing. It does some of the things that I like about some other things I've recommended in the past. I recommended at one point, I know, something called Write Room, which basically blacks out the rest of your screen and only gives you the document you're working on. It does that, but it also does a whole bunch of other things. It's essentially it allows you to break up the paper you're working on, the document, the book chapter, whatever it is, into little bits of text. And then it makes it very easy to edit those blocks of text by moving them around. It has a corkboard interface where it displays all the little snippets of text as little index cards that you can then drag and drop into to change the order in which they appear. It'll allow you to split the screen so you can be looking at one bit of text alongside another bit of text that may be further down in the document and then move things between them. It allows you to tag and label these bits of text with different keywords so that you can go and find them very easily. It's really good for instance, if you're let's say you're trying to expand a conference paper that you gave into a longer journal article. And you are kind of taking the outline that you produced for the conference and building it out. It allows you very easily to kind of take those bits, the existing text, and fill it in with additional text. It's also great if you're trying to combine two different pieces of two different drafts that you've written, or if, for instance, you're trying to reorganize a draft that you have. Let's say you've organized your chapter for a historian, you've organized it chronologically. So you have a chronological narrative and you decide, you know, this doesn't really work. I want to organize it biographically. It has a really good search. So you can search for people's names and then kind of pull every bit of text that has their name out and put that into a new document so that then you all of a sudden just have just the stuff about that one person, and you've now been able to organize your work biographically. It's a little hard to explain. You've really got to check it out. And I think everybody, and I don't normally like to do this. I normally like to jump into software, but if you're going to try it out, I would really recommend doing the tutorial when you start, because there's a lot of features in there that you probably won't understand or see if you don't do the tutorial. But I really recommend it to everybody. It's Scrivener. It's at literatureandlatte.com.
Sounds great. Yeah, and we should mention this is I'm not sure if you did, but it's Mac only.
Yeah, it is Mac only. Yeah. That unfortunately.
Right. Okay, sounds good. Well, one thing that I noticed over the past couple of weeks that I'm actually going to try, so I'm going to go ahead and purchase one of these, and we can discuss it on the next podcast. But this is a really interesting experiment, a non-commercial project to connect up all the digitization that's going on of public domain books. So we're thinking here of things like the work of the Open Content Alliance and the Google Book search program. And it's connecting that up with a print-on-demand service called Lulu.com to allow you to order any of 1.7 million books online, and they'll go ahead and print it out, put a cover on it, and send it to you. So these are books that are public domain, generally meaning before 1923, and you can order any of these. They'll send it right to you. And so I'm going to go ahead and print one of these out and see what it looks like, but I think it's a really interesting experiment, and what's really neat is, you know, it's like a giant back catalog of so many books. And of course, as a Victorianist, I'm really excited about this. These are books that haven't been in print for 100 or 150 years, and you can now get some of these first editions of books and have it printed out on real paper. Take that Amazon with your Kindle, and we'll see what that looks like and talk about it first thing in 2 weeks on Digital Campus number 20. Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you